between the wisdom passed down by ancient healing traditions, anecdotal experience, and modern clinical trials, one thing is clear: mushrooms are medicinal powerhouses. And I finally found a brand, a product, a company that I feel really aligns with all of my research and understanding when it comes to the medicinal properties of mushrooms, and that is Alchemy Mushrooms. They grow their mushrooms in California on organic mushroom farms. They keep the whole mushroom in their supplements, and they actually blend mycelium and fruit body in their mushroom powders and capsules to give you the best of both worlds. You can learn more at Alchemy Mushrooms. That's A-L-C-H-E-M-I. AlchemyMushrooms.com. Use the discount code MushroomHour for 20% off your order. Alchemy with an I, Mushrooms.com. Hi there. Welcome to Mushroom Hour. Today on Mushroom Hour, we're joined by the distinguished and prolific George Poynard Jr., PhD. George received his PhD in biology from Cornell University and spent most of his career in the Department of Entomology at the University of California at Berkeley before moving to Oregon State University, where he is a professor in the Department of Integrative Biology. His interest in the tropics, along with a passion for paleontology, culminated in the book The Amber Forest, co-authored with his wife, Roberta, and published by Princeton University Press. He is also the author of other books, including Life in Amber. In addition, he is a founder of the Amber Institute, a pioneer when it comes to studying associations between invertebrates and other organisms trapped in amber. One of his projects was recently all over the news as he discovered a new genus and species of fungal entomoparasite growing out of a fossilized ant. This is the oldest fungus growing out of an ant that has ever been recorded. Dr. Poynard, thank you so much for joining us on the Mushroom Hour.
Yeah, nice to meet you too.
Well, in the little I know of your backstory and your career, there is a massive story to tell, but as best you can, tell us some of the highlights or the key moments that put you on this path toward studying fungi, studying organisms trapped in amber.
Okay, well, I can say that I started out my career actually as a teenager as a naturalist. And what I did is I spent a lot of time just wandering around in the woods on my own often. And little by little, I became interested. Well, I regarded Thoreau was my hero, and I used to read Walden all the time. And I just, you know, I just love nature. And so I traveled around, and I became pretty good at identifying birds. And then, so I decided that I'm going to go to Cornell University and major in ornithology under Kellogg and Allen. They were both famous ornithologists there. So that's how I started my career. I worked with them for a while, and then the money ran out, and I needed to get some to continue in there. And so I accepted an assistantship in entomology under George Driscoll, and I started studying the parasites of the recently introduced alfalfa weevil in New York State. And while I was going to Cornell, I had the opportunity of taking the course of Richard Korff, who was a noted mycologist. Dick Korff was one of the most inspiring teachers I ever had. Because of that, I decided to minor in mycology. And so I took his course and minored in mycology. And then after graduating from Cornell, I worked for short periods on various projects involving insect pathology around the world. I wanted to get some experience of different parts of the country. I wanted to travel. I wanted to see the world. I wanted to meet other scientists. And so this gave me additional experience with the fungal diseases of plants and insects. And while I eventually took a permanent position in Berkeley, and this actually worked out well because I was in charge of a service called the Insect Diagnostic Laboratory, where people, scientists, could send us any insect, dead insect or something, and then ask us to identify what caused the death. Now, sometimes these were scientists that were trying to raise insects, and the pathogen was killing them off. Other scientists had the insects, and they wanted to find a pathogen that could be used as biological control of these insects.
Right.
And so these were the reasons that we started this diagnostic service. And we conducted research on these pathogens, and then eventually we wrote a book called The Laboratory Guide to Insect Pathogens and Parasites. And then we went on, and then I decided, before we got started on at Berkeley, I decided to travel around. I actually started my career in the Department of Biological Control at the University of California in Riverside. And I studied plant pathogens there from 1962 to 1964. Then I had an opportunity to go to England and work with the scientists at the Rothamsted Experiment Station in Harpenden. And so I spent a year there working with the English scientists in the laboratory, on various projects, nematodes, fungi, and things like that. And that was very interesting. I got to learn the English food, the English manners, never to say backyard. It's always the garden, not a backyard.
Right. You became an Anglophile.
Yeah, right. A few years later then, after England, I received a grant from the South Pacific Commission to study fungal and nematode parasites on insects attacking coconuts in different areas of the world.
And hugely relevant.
Yeah, I accepted this. And this began in my first place was to study coconuts at the Coconut Palm Experiment Station in Apia, Western Samoa. And so I spent some time in Western Samoa looking for looking for coconut pathogens. And I remember getting off the plane, the first thing they did was to give me a number of pills. And I said, "What are these pills for?" And he says, "Well, we have a disease called filariasis here, and everyone getting off the plane here has to take these pills in order to make sure that he doesn't get filariasis on the island." So I did. And I worked there for a while. And then I continued at other sites where coconuts were being grown. And the first one included the Lowlands Research Experiment Station in Rabaul, Papua New Guinea. Hmm. And so I spent a period there, which is also very interesting, just to see how the people lived and then the habits and things of them. It was fascinating. We went out in the field. It was so hot there, we had to cut down trees and open the trees up and then find the larvae of these insects that were killing the trees and then look for pathogens, fungi and nematodes that were on these larvae. Now, it was so hot there that you'd start to cut these down and it was just exhausting. So we had locals come in, and there was a group of people there that were able to work in this heat and open these things up for us. So we found some very interesting organisms there and described. And then I wanted to continue the work. And so we went from there to the Department of Biology to University of Malaysia in Kuala Lumpur. And we worked for a while on the coconut plants that were there and doing the same thing, opening them up and finding pathogens. And then using these pathogens, testing them out, usually would leave the pathogens there and their own technicians would then take over and test these against the coconut insects, which were these big rhinoceros beetles and the coconut weevil also, Rhynchophorus and Oryctes. These rhinoceros beetles are very, very large. I have some here I can show. Well, still, I have some in the back room there in collection boxes. So anyway, that was interesting. Then they wanted us to also search for the same insects at the International Wright Institute in Los Baños, Philippines. So we went to the Philippines, and we worked there for a while on the same thing. And again, while you go to these places, you meet the scientists. It's not just the work that you turns you on, but how people were living, how people made their, you know, work, how they solved their problems and everything. And that was a wonderful experience. And after Philippines, then we were sent to the Department of Entomology at University of Bangkok in Thailand. And we worked there for a while also, for a period, doing the same things. But again, with a different group of people, and very interesting to see how in different countries, different people have slightly different ways of going about things. Anyway, it was very interesting, very interesting. Then we ended up at the Botanic Gardens in Singapore, mainly because these insects, in this case, were attacking palms in the Botanic Gardens. So it wasn't a case of the palms being used for the coconuts and things like that. Not the coconut palm. These were commercial palms. So we worked there for a while. And then after that, I decided that I really needed some experience in working with pathogens, fungi pathogens of insects. And at that time, there was a big, I met Marshall Laird, who is in charge of a study that was going on pathogens of insects in Africa. And so I was asked to go over to Africa and search for pathogens, fungi and nematodes and anything else, of black fly vectors of elephantiasis, tsetse fly vectors of sleeping sickness, and mosquito vectors of malaria. And so I went over there and was stationed at the Laboratoire de Parasitology in Abidjan, Ivory Coast. And this involved traveling through parts of Western Africa, where I actually acquired malaria myself. And was, I always remember, it happened, I was living at this little house outside of Abidjan, and all of a sudden, I began to start sweating. Getting really hot. It was warm already. So I went in the house, turned on the cold shower, and then stood there, and slowly getting cool and cool. And then all of a sudden, I started shaking. This is a part of the ways of the malaria parasites coming out of your blood cells. And so I turned off the shower, the cold water, and turned on the hot water because I was actually quite cold, and stayed there until the hot water left, and then drove myself to the hospital, and then was given chloridane, you know, until it went away. But even after I came back to California, then I would get periods of shaking, because the malaria was still with me, and it stayed there for a while until I could finally get rid of it. Anyway, that was a very interesting,
a harrowing part of that whole journey around the world, getting malaria. But, you know, with going to that many different places, the South Pacific, parts of Africa, and to come out relatively unscathed, save for that, I think you did pretty well for yourself.
Yeah, I was lucky. I was lucky. Some people weren't so lucky, but I was fortunate. And then after I finished the African project, I wanted to work further with nematode and fungal parasites. And I wanted to visit some of the scientists that were working on these parasites and see how they classified them and how they were going to do this. So at that time, I applied for and received an international grant that allowed me to visit workers in Russia at the Academy of Science there. And so this was in St. Petersburg and also in Moscow. And so when I went over there, I met scientists like Rubtsov, Kiryanova, EC. They were conducting research on insect diseases, especially the nematodes and the fungi. And I had taken a crash course in Russian before I left, and I carried a dictionary with me at all times. And when time permitted, I'd run over to the Hermitage Museum which was a beautiful museum there, one of the most beautiful in the world today. And look at the artwork. I was always interested in painting. And it was a very, very wonderful, wonderful museum. I don't know if you've been to Russia at all.
No, I've not. A notoriously challenging language, too. So, I mean, you've already talked about this tapestry of all these cultures. Now add Russia into the mix. I mean, man, you are truly a man of the world.
Well, it was interesting because when I go to the museum, Hermitage Museum, there's a lot of rooms. They're all interconnected. Every time I went, I got lost. I couldn't find my way out. And so I had to ask the guards, sometimes two guards, to point to me, what's the exit? How do you get out of this?
Was this a period, too, where the relationship between the U.S. and Russia had some tension? I mean, that's pretty much been the case for nigh on 60 or 70 years. But was that the case when you visited?
Yeah, that was a Cold War. Cold War was on. And so we had to have our passport. We had to have passports all the time. And we had to have sometimes in Moscow, we were always followed by guards. We weren't free to go where we wanted to. We always had guards following us. They would stay outside the building when we went in to talk to the scientists. And then they would kind of, sometimes they made themselves inconspicuous, you know, like three or four, maybe half a block away from us. But we could always spot them.
That adds another layer of kind of excitement to the whole adventure.
Yeah, it does.
I'm sure at the time it wasn't seen as exciting. It may have been a bit stressful, but.
In fact, there was so much to do. It was so busy that I lost 30 pounds when I was there. I was like a skeleton afterwards because every place there was something to do, something to go to, and the food lines were so long that sometimes we'd just say, okay, let's skip the meal. Let's skip the meals. There's too many people in line for the food.
More science, more art.
Yeah. And then at the end, all the foreign workers who came to Russia had to give a seminar at the end of their stay in Russian language. And it was funny. I remember before I went, I checked with some other Americans that were over there to find out what I was in for. With the one American, I asked him, how did your talk go? He said, well, you know, I had no trouble giving my talk, but the audience, they had trouble.
Yeah, I don't think your Russian handbook or the Russian language handbook was going to be enough to save that presentation.
Yeah, and so actually, my audience was very polite, and they said they could understand most of what I was saying.
Fantastic. Well, Russia, like I said, Russian is a notoriously difficult language. So
yeah, and then after Russia, I decided that I needed to work more with some people on the animal parasites of vertebrates, for instance, the nematode and the fungi parasites. So I spent a year in Paris at the laboratory of Chabot, working at the laboratory of zoology, taking French classes at night in order to get through them. And so that was quite interesting. Just living in Paris for a while.
I'm sure.
That was quite something. And then after that, I went to Holland to work with some of the scientists there, especially with van der Laan at the University of Amsterdam, and then de Wilde and Oostenbrink at the Agriculture University in Wageningen. Learning Dutch after German was difficult, but the two languages are close. But all the Dutch scientists spoke almost perfect English, so there was no problem there. That was a very interesting, going through Amsterdam, through the canal, the Grand Canal, and seeing all of those. I'm glad I did that because now, you know, with the COVID on, you know, you don't know what you can do or where you should go. After that, I went to Romania. I worked at the Forest Research Institute there, looking for diseases on forest trees, insects attacking forest trees. And that was very interesting. I took a crash course in Romanian just before I left. And we communicated mostly with a mixture of English, French, and Romanian. because the Romanian is a Romance language, and so right. it's nearer French than the other languages around him, like Hungarian, which is quite different. Anyway, it was certainly interesting to hear all these different languages. And then I came back, and after we closed down the Insect Diagnostic Service lab, then I decided to start investigating the history, ancient history of these things, of the things that we've been studying. This began with my wife and I leading a expedition to the Dominican Republic. We took a group of people to the Dominican Republic and went through the amber mines there. At that time, we met many amber dealers, such as Brozinski, Jim Work, Dan McCauley, and others. And they supplied us with some wonderful specimens, many of which are still in my collection, undescribed yet. After that, we spent a year in New Zealand and Australia looking for the trees that produced amber. Because over there, one of the trees is the cowrie. And this is Agathis in the Araucariaceae. Are you familiar with botany at all? Or?
You know, I have a rough working knowledge of botany, but not enough to identify really most plant genuses, I'll have to admit.
Okay.
And actually, you just described a magnificent career traveling the world, investigating fungal parasites and pathogens. But I know amber is this whole other arc of your career that has spawned and influenced so many different things, none the least of which Jurassic Park, that most of us have probably heard of. So why don't you lay out the basics for us, which it sounds like you were just about to do, the basics of what amber is even and how it's formed. I think most people are familiar with what it looks like, but yeah, what maybe some of the plants that produce it and how is it formed over time?
Yeah. That's a good question. Let's see. I decided that amber was the best way to search back in the past and look for traces of insect diseases, including fungi and nematodes. Now, amber is a fossilized resin. It's produced from trees like the cowrie or the guapanal. And this is Agathis species and Hymenaea species. And because the resin doesn't deteriorate, like most pine resin that you have, will deteriorate after a while. It doesn't preserve. And while the exact process of preservation of it's unknown, certain products in the resin become active immediately after organisms have been entombed, long before the resin hardens. These chemicals act as natural embalming agents that fix and dehydrate the organism's tissue. The long period of polymerization ensues, during which the amber hardens, the resin hardens, and volatile terpenes in the resins escape, and non-volatile terpenes bind together to foreign compounds resistant to natural decay. The amber we detected from the Dominican Republic is what we call raw amber. It's broken. People go into the vein. We went into the mines and watched the people work in the mines. It's after a while, I got claustrophobic. Because I was crawling in on my stomach and you'd go back where it was dark. And the only light that the miners had was a candle. And they'd put the candle on a rock here. And then they'd start pounding away with their hammer at the vein. And the amber pieces would come falling out. And then they would have to put those in a sack and then go in further. And all the time, I realized, you know, I had read previously that when earthquakes occur, these tunnels can collapse. And so I was hoping that no earthquakes would occur while
I'm getting claustrophobic just thinking about it. I mean, a candle, come on, guys, we can at least get a flashlight. A little harrowing, yeah.
Yeah, the candle. And what they used with the candle, though, was not just for light, because they'd be working, and as soon as the candle started flicking and going out, they realized that the oxygen was levels down, and they had to get out quick. The candle was like a signpost that said, get out of here because there's a lack of oxygen.
Yeah, yeah.
And then what happens is a long period of after this polymerization, then the urine becomes amber. And the raw amber requires also always processing. You know, you get these rough pieces, and most people don't realize the amount of work that goes into preparing amber before specimens can be adequately studied and photographed. The amber must be reshaped in order to see the specimen from the top, bottom, and side. Now, this can be done by using a lapidary trim saw with a diamond blade to cut the amber down to working size. Further trimming is done on a belt sander using different size sandpapers. A continuous flow of water should be applied during this process to keep the amber cool and wash away particles from the surface of the piece. Finally, the amber is polished on a bench grinder to remove scratches. Obtaining the correct wax for the buffing wheel is important in order to get a smooth, shiny finish. The most difficult challenge is within small fossils that are only a few millimeters in size. Holding a tiny amber piece tightly against the sander and buffing wheel until the specimen is close enough to the surface to be examined with a compound microscope often ends in bloody fingers. And my wife always knows when I come up from polishing because I have scars and bandages on my finger.
Oh my gosh, okay.
These techniques were honed years ago when I took evening lapidary classes at Berkeley.
It's almost like creating, I mean, the similar processes to creating jewelry is what you have to do to prepare a specimen just to even be analyzed.
Yes, just to even to examine it. And then you have to kind of focus in and look for particular characters. The closest I needed to do this was with a little seed, an orchid seed that was in amber. And in order to get, so I could look at it almost under oil immersion, I had to get so close to the seed, which was only a couple millimeters long by itself, so close that I could almost, it looked like it had just fallen on the amber. And it had a fungus growing into it. I was going to get into that a little bit later. A mycorrhizal fungus that was inside the orchid developing. So I worked on this and described both of them. But mycorrhizal fungi are a wonderful group, very interesting groups. People don't realize that most of the plants we have around us, larger plants, have mycorrhizal fungi in their roots developing there. And mycorrhizal fungi are not just on the roots of things, because in orchids, most of the orchid seeds need a mycorrhizal fungus to germinate. And it's fascinating. It's fascinating.
Orchids are a fascinating example, yeah, as a mycorrhizal obligate. Yeah, they would not exist without mycorrhizal fungi, which, like you said, is the case for 95% of plants on the Earth's surface. But orchids especially are famous for not being able to even have their seeds germinate without them. Incredible. And you found this. Do you have an estimate of how old that specimen was? And maybe this gets into just figuring out the process for figuring out how old any of these specimens are.
Yeah, the age of this comes from different methods of dating the sediment in which the amber is found. Now,
that makes sense.
The problem is that some people use foraminifera, and they'll come up with a particular date. Another scientist will use coccoliths, and they'll come up with a different date. And so we know that a lot of the amber was redeposited. So we know that it's older than the sediment in which it is on. But we don't know sometimes how much older. And that's why we give a range. And the largest range is the Dominican amber, which the smallest age was 15 million. The largest age was 40 million. So somewhere in between there. And it's hard to pinpoint it. So we have to give a range. But I think the most interesting fungal parasite of plants we found in amber was the 100-million-year-old ergot. I don't know if you know about that or not.
I'm not familiar with that specimen in particular, but 100 million year old ergot. And ergot funguses have affected human society massively. I mean, even today, there are edible ergots. And of course, the famous LSD is derived from an ergot fungus. But you found a 100 million year old ergot fungus. Tell us about that specimen and what that find was like.
Okay, yes. Well, you're right. LSD is one of the compounds from there. We named it Paleocleviceps parasiticus, and it had grown a sclerotium in a grass spikelet. It's known that the sclerotia on present-day ergot have heat-stable chemicals that are poisonous to animals, including humans that eat ergot-infected grain. Some 40,000 people died during the ergot epidemic in France back in 994 AD, thousands more in the Middle Ages. This is the earliest record of a ergot and a member of the Clavicipitaceae in a plant. And when we found it, everyone had wanted to know if dinosaurs could have been affected.
Right, if they were eating the ergot, yeah.
And you see a high dinosaur. Dinosaurs get high. It's possible that sauropods, ankylosaurs, and other herbivores consumed these grasses and became intoxicated, since there are records of birds and reptiles being affected. And by examining some dinosaur coprolites, scientists know that some dinosaurs ate grasses. So they would have eaten them, but whether they had an effect on them is not known.
That's a question lost in the sands of time. If dinosaurs got high off of ergot infested grasses.
Yeah, I can see the dinosaur parties and everything. Anyway,
when you get a specimen like that, are there other inspections you do as well other than microscopic?
Yeah. You have to put it under the microscope, and then you have to get to just the right angle and everything. And then you need lighting. The lighting is important. You have to have lighting coming from above as well as below. Usually with every specimen now that we get, they're so tiny, especially with a lot of the flowers. A lot of the flowers range between 2 millimeters and 5 millimeters only. And so we have to go under the microscope to see some of the characters, the veins, the glands, the nectar glands, the pollen, the structure of the pollen, structure of the anthers, and all of this. It's quite something. After we did that, that was interesting because we can turn to the ant parasite that we talked about earlier, because that's the same member of the same general group as the ergot one.
And this is the now widely publicized oldest entomopathogenic fungi ever found growing out of an ant.
Yeah, yes, it is. And this was a parasite of a carpenter ant in the Baltic amber. It was an interesting study since there were fungal stages that are unknown on today's ant parasites. And the new genus is characterized by an orange stalk cup-shaped Ascoma. I call it a mushroom, even though it's not, it's in common terms a mushroom because it looks like a mushroom. It's not a basidiomycete like general mushroom, but I call it a mushroom. It had partially emerged parathesi attached to the rectum of the ant, and then it had two separate stomata with stepate mycelium emerging from the base of the neck and abdomen of the ant, and then it had freestanding parathesia bearing assi with ascospores and heart spores too. This is the oldest fossil genus of an ant, and it's fossil fungus of an ant. And it shows unique morphological features that existed in the Hypocreales some 45 to 55 million years ago. Now, we don't know if this fungus caused the ant to climb up and clasp a plant stem, as some of the recent species do. And this is how the parasitized ants got the name zombie, since the mushroom in them arises from the ant's head. And so people say it's from the head. So it destroys the brain. It modifies the brain of the ant. So then the ant's going to do you know, going to climb up on the stem, bite the stem, and then die, perish. And then the mushroom can come out further and develop. And we don't know if this was a type of zombie like that, since the mushroom doesn't arise from the head, but could arise. There's one coming out, looked like it coming out of the neck. The origin of the fungal bodies is unknown. These are little structures next to the ant, little bodies. They could have emerged from the body of the ant, or like the fungal body arising from the ant's petiole, or from deteriorating stromata. Aside from these unique freestanding bodies, Alacordyceps shares some features with members of both the Clavicipitaceae and Cordycipitaceae. The study can be used in future phylogenetic work to establish a reference point regarding the origin of ant parasitism by fungi.
That was one of my central questions, because I know on the show, and many listeners at this point have been familiarized with Ophiocordyceps, and some of these Cordycipitaceae are members of the Cordycipitaceae family, because there are such these vivid images of ants and other insects with those fingers emerging out of them, and it's captured everyone's imagination. Yeah. And that was my question, was whether this specimen looked like phylogenetically as an ancestor that these eventually branched from, or something developing in parallel.
Yes, yes. No, I agree with you. My feeling is that we don't know exactly how this fungus ramiates through the body of the ant. It's like a cancer. It just goes everywhere. And then this one came out of the rectum. They're going to come out of the easiest place they can. Those that come out of the head of the ant usually come out of the neck, because there's a joint there. They rarely come out of the top of the head of the ant. They need some opening or some joint or some intersegmental membrane in order to come out. And I think that this, what we found, is a predecessor of what we have today.
And then how did this specimen come to you? I mean, were you the one that found it in the field, or how did this make it to George Poignard's lab and desk, if you will?
Well, actually, it was sent to me by a German scholar who had gone to Burma and obtained it directly from Burma. Wow. And then he sent it to us for identification. And fortunately, we have a scientist here at Oregon State who's an expert on this particular group. And so he was able to study it further. So that was the ergot one. Sorry. The Baltic amber one was actually picked up at a gem and mineral show by a French scientist. And that was sent to me to study. And after studying it, I returned it to them, and it'll eventually go to the Paris Museum.
Probably one of the most legendary finds at a gem and mineral show, I'm going to say ever, because like many people, I love going to see gems and minerals, but I've never thought of finding an incredibly ancient fossilized fungi. But now I think we should all go and surround all of the amber tables looking for new scientific discoveries. And then what is that process like? Because this, we're talking about identifying this genus, but how are you extracting genetic data really about any organism that you find encased in amber? You know, I referenced in the introduction, famously, your work in talking about extracting genetics from amber inspired ideas behind Jurassic Park. But what is the mechanism for actually extracting useful genetic data from amber specimens?
Well, first of all, you have to get the right specimen. It has to be fresh. It has to be completely in a good condition when it was entombed, not diseased or anything.
Okay.
And it has to be entombed right away, like flying in and then covered up. Part of it can't be out where it can be oxidized or where other things can attack it. So this is one of the problems. The other is having sterile conditions, very sterile conditions when you're working with it. It's a chance situation too. And you have to get the right situation. Now, we're waiting for new techniques are being developed on being able to extract DNA from various organisms, fossil organisms. So we're waiting until some of these are established, fully established, and shown to work. And then we feel that there'll be more people able to get DNA out of these specimens.
Yeah, because I know genomics and genetic sequencing tools are changing so much. So I would imagine there'd be a lot of changes, or those changes would affect this field greatly.
Yeah, a lot of people have tried and didn't get anything. They weren't able to get anything, but we have actually been able to get it from even a weevil that was 130 million years old. Not many, just a little bit of fragmented DNA, but that's it. And then we got it from a plant from Dominican amber and a bee also. So this is very exciting, especially yeah. since our paper, when we did a paper on looking for DNA, the presence of DNA in a Baltic amber specimen, we're actually able to show chromatin there. And this is a paper that stimulated Michael Crichton. Now, he came to our lab after that, and he talked about it. And he said, and then he wrote a letter, and he said, you know, I wrote this book, Jurassic Park, but I'm stuck because I don't know how to get the DNA of the dinosaurs. And then he said, now I do.
How realistic is that? I mean, we're talking about new tools being developed, but in the instance of Jurassic Park, they're pulling DNA from not the mosquito's DNA, but DNA within the mosquito of these dinosaurs. I mean, is that level of granular DNA analysis possible or possible in the near horizon?
It might be possible in the near horizon. And again, it's getting the right specimen. You have to get a mosquito that just took the blood. I mean, right now, I'm very interested in mosquitoes that are able to possibly transmit the blood of COVID patients from one person to another, because wow. that's what we've been looking at. And we haven't done any experiments yet, but we're comparing it. I did a little paper comparing what's known about mosquito transmission and whether it would be possible, what viruses are transmitted today by mosquitoes. Anyway, you have to get the mosquito. It has to take in the blood before the blood is digested. So you'd go into the gut of the mosquito in order to take this out. You wouldn't take it, could look into the hemocele and take the hemocytes or the plasmatocytes or anything like that.
Okay.
And I think it's possible to get some DNA, whether you could get a DNA to reconstruct the entire dinosaur. I don't think so.
So there is some truth there, but again, we need some healthy suspension of disbelief. And as you've taken samples, because I would imagine you're working with some of the oldest specimens anyone is dealing with, especially when we talk about generating even fragmented genetic data, just any genetic data at all. Has this been a challenge? And I don't even know if you're necessarily doing all of the kind of genetic phylogeny part of things, but has this been a challenge or shaken up any phylogenetic trees for different genuses or different organisms, maybe families, orders, even kingdoms of life, based on any of the genetic data you've gotten from these very ancient specimens?
Yes, we can't say, because the DNA has been fractured, that we can't really use it to reconstruct phylogenies, unfortunately. Yeah, I think that we're looking forward to this. This would be very interesting. We had people that wanted to, actually, we had a paper on discussing the perfumes, the early origin of perfumes in the world, and that the perfumes, actually, there are perfume, evidence of perfumes in some of the flowers, 100 million year old flowers. We can see drops of oil. We can see things coming out of glands, which would be ancient perfumes, really.
That's incredible. And that brings us to the modern day, you know, talking about the work you're currently doing, which mosquitoes carrying COVID, that's a whole new area of exploration. But when we talk about working with amber, you're a seminal figure in doing any of this, really one of the few people I've heard of working with amber specimens. But where is this practice or maybe scientific exploration today? You know, have many people gotten into this type of research? I know your wife and yourself started the Amber Institute. Maybe talk about where that is. I guess the general landscape of studying amber fossilized specimens today.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people are studying amber insects today. It's very popular, very popular, especially from China. And I get questions from scientists every day. They'll send me a specimen, a picture of a specimen. They'll say, "What is this?" And some of the specimens are actually quite interesting. And some are very curious, like the weevil, the mammoth weevil that we had. That had this elongate snout on it. And it reminded me of some of the Attenborough films where he showed lucanid beetles with long snouts like this, fighting the males, fighting each other for females, knocking each other down, and then in order to get to the female. We feel that this probably happened with this 100 million year old weevil too, because it's damaged and it has that, its head, it's a male, and we showed some damage, like one leg was detached. So we think that it may have been one of the victims of a stronger male that knocked it down and knocked it into a pool of resin. And there it lay until we found it 100 million years later.
Amazing. It's just amazing the window that you get into the ancient past where you're able to see a duel between mammoth weevils just from one of these ancient specimens.
That's right. That's right. We now know that after working with all these different specimens, we know that one of the most important characters for survival is adaptability. If a specimen can't adapt, if an insect can't adapt, a plant can't adapt, it becomes extinct. If it can adapt, sometimes then its lineages come all the way down to the present. Modified, of course, but the genetics is still there. The genetics is probably still there because the morphological characters that are governed by these things can still be found, although modified. So this is quite interesting. And we know that those not able to adapt extinct. And this is why malaria and COVID are so worrisome. They constantly change their genome. And while they may have some morphological differences, the new strains have essentially the same basic genotype as their predecessors. And other genes are being expressed. And this happens now. We know that viruses, we can find viruses back 100 million years ago, we actually find the viruses in the amber.
In the amber specimens.
In the specimens, in the vectors that are carrying them, yeah. You can actually find the polyhedra. You can actually find malaria. Malarial stages go back to 100 million years too. So they've been there for a long time, and they've adapted with the insect over such a long time that they are now able to modify themselves for survival. So we're trying to kill them off, but they're using their ancient techniques to avoid our methods that we're using. And the vaccines that we're using now, who knows? Who knows how good they are, how long they'll stay? It's not known. So much is unknown from it.
Absolutely. And I think there's something similar with influenza vaccines. You know, can you predict the strain that will have adapted or changed for the coming season? I think that's always going to be the challenge.
Yes, yes.
In helping the human body adapt to viruses, if you're going to do what is essentially a biological upgrade with a vaccine, will it win that arms race with the constantly adapting and changing virus?
Yes, yes. I think that you're right on that point. I agree with you. Well, one other thing I wanted to mention about these fungi are the nematode-trapping fungi. Are you familiar with fungi that actually kill nematodes?
I've only heard a little bit about this, but the idea that sometimes they could spear nematodes or create, yeah, traps, kind of what looks like a loop that will tighten around the nematode. And from what I've read, sometimes these are mushrooms that are classically saprobic or whose main niche or lifestyle revolves around decomposing lignin and other detritus, but they'll still retain this ability to capture nematodes. But what has your work revealed about these nematode hunting or trapping fungi?
Yeah, this is another thing. We found them in amber. We've actually found the fungi inside the nematodes. It penetrated inside the nematodes in amber.
That would seem one in a trillion to actually find that in amber.
I know. It is. Aside from some groups of stylet-bearing nematodes that feed on fungi, are the fungi that have evolved special features allowing them to parasitize nematodes. A few of these features are, like you said, trapping devices that predatory fungi produce on their hyphae. In other words, the fungus is growing, and the fungus can detect, oh, there's nematodes here. So I'm going to produce a hyphae with some traps on it, and these are going to be trapping devices. One type is a sticky adhesive organ, like you said, that holds the nematodes while an infection peg enters its body. Another is a hyphal ring that closes on the nematode when it attempts to crawl through. An infection peg from the ring then invades the nematode. Other fungi release spores that become attached to soil nematodes and penetrate the nematode cuticle during germination. Fascinating how smart these fungi are.
And has there been overlap, whether we're talking about those nematode spearing or trapping fungi, or whether we're talking about the Allocordyceps baltica or baltica that you found in that ant specimen? Have there been mycologists that have come in, maybe experts in those respective types of fungal organisms, to see maybe not genetically, but functionally and macroscopically how they relate to the modern, maybe versions or descendants of those fungi, to see how they've changed? Maybe the nematode trapping has, or maybe it hasn't changed over millions of years.
Well, it appears to be very similar to the present day forms, very similar. You can find them, the nematodes. We described the nematode, Oligoamphalincus atrabora. And we show that the fungi are all around the population. We found a whole population of nematodes with fungi. And so we could look at the fungi, and these fungi had already started to parasitize the nematodes. And we got that in a piece of amber. This piece of amber happened to come from Mexico, in Mexican amber, which is a different source of amber, but still, it's about 20 to 30 million years old, and it shows that this was happening back then. And we figure that probably it was from a decaying part of the trunk of the tree that was being invaded by the fungi, and then the nematodes came in to feed on the fungi. But then the fungi got back at the nematodes by parasitizing them. A two-way street here.
A battle between fungi and nematode. And just with how you're describing this, it seems like some of these pieces of amber, yeah, are capturing scenarios that would be almost impossible to think that the probability of those events, or that kind of diorama of different organisms interacting that you get encased in amber, would kind of happen. I mean, in your expert opinion, how many more discoveries about the ancient past, and this would seem to be the most direct discovery where you're seeing the actual organisms in stasis doing what they were doing when they were captured. How much more is there to be discovered in these little universes of amber? I mean, do you think that we have found most of the most notable specimens, or is it the case that there are probably incredible discoveries isolated in amber around the world that will take, you know, decades, centuries to fully explore?
Actually, and every time I look at a piece of amber, I enter the world of the amber. I come immersed in it, and looking around as if I'm there, and if the trees were actually out there, and I'm just part of that forest, just a significant part. And it's, I have to remember, it's an instant of time. It's not a long period, it's just an instant of time. And you have to think what was before and what was after that period of time. And then you can kind of put things together like that. But as I said, I'm down here working alone and I lose myself in the amber. It's easy to do. And many people, because fungi are so small, many people don't recognize the fungi. And so you have to have an idea of what fungi actually look like in amber and how it compares with. It's not the same as looking at a stained slide that shows the mycelia all in blue or green or red. Right. It's not that. It's different. You have to kind of immerse yourself into it. And one thing I know for sure, fungi that date back billions of years will still be around long after humans exist.
Humans may negatively infect our environment to where we can't exist anymore, but the fungi will adapt and continue.
Oh, yeah.
Long after we've left.
Yeah, they will.
Well, Dr. Poynar, where can people find your work, the work of the Amber Institute? Where is the best place to go for people to find out more about your amazing works in amber?
Oh, I think that's on ResearchGate. My publications are listed there. So that's probably the best place to go.
And thank you for highlighting that resource. I found that ResearchGate is an amazing place to find about most academics or scientists, find all of their papers. So yes, thank you for that. So go to ResearchGate, type in George Poynar. And just to loop your early career with your later career, is it fair to characterize your work in the early days as kind of exploring the diversity of parasites with an applied use as biocontrol in mind, to eventually you became so fascinated with the organisms and started peering into these universes of amber that it became less about the applied use necessarily and more about just learning about these organisms? Is that kind of fair to say, or how would you characterize that arc of such varied research all around the world?
Yes, well, it's when you're starting off research, in order you want to make contact with other scientists to see what they're doing and what they have done, and to decide if you're going to, which one you're going to follow. A lot of them have come up with their own ideas on things, and so you analyze them and you decide, well, this is right. I'm going to follow this person. I'm going to follow this man, this scientist here. On the other hand, you want to see what the other ideas are also. And I think that traveling around, aside from just looking for nematodes and fungi, parasites of pestiferous insects and medical parasites and things like that, it's just learning the techniques, seeing what people have in their labs, how they look at things, how they do things. And then you get a tolerance also of the people. You understand them better. More people should do that to realize that, you know, peace is better than war.
Absolutely. It's one of the major themes when you're talking about your travels around the world. It seemed like just the pursuit of knowledge and scientific discovery totally overrides the oft times manufactured divisions between countries and peoples. And you were able to glide between so many different cultures, of course, with, you know, sometimes guards following you around, but you were able to make connections around the world in a way that was not put behind barriers of cultural difference because you were united by science. It's a beautiful story.
Thank you.
Well, I'll wrap things up with just one question to send us off. And I have a feeling you'll have a very unique answer potentially for us. Maybe you'll name something that only existed millions of years ago. But if you can pick from all these different specimens that you've had the chance to study and research, you know, what is a mushroom or a fungus that you love and why? And this does not have to be a favorite. It could just be something that holds a special place, you know, but a mushroom or fungus that you love and why?
Well, if there was a single one, I would say probably the ergot. But the one of the mushroom cap with the parasite attacking the cap, and then a hyperparasite inside the parasite attacking that was there, is one of the most fascinating I've ever worked on. Because here is a 100-million-year-old mushroom cap sitting there, beautiful. And then when you look closely, you can see, oh, it's ramified. Here are all of these other filaments on it. And then when you look closer, inside those filaments is a more narrow fungus going through, producing its own type of spores, each one own type of spores. So here's a combination of hyperparasitism in a mushroom.
Okay, we may have saved the best for last. That's absolutely incredible. And you were able to see all of that just through microscopy, obviously with decades of experience, but just through microscopy, you were able to identify those different players.
Yes, yes, we did.
That's amazing. I think, thank you, Dr. Poynar, for taking us into your universes of amber, sharing the incredible insights therein. And we've highlighted some of the kind of most publicized finds and ideas, but I really encourage people to read the full breadth of your work for any mycophile, for someone just starting out to the most advanced or knowledgeable. There's information in there for everyone. It seems like every article or every paper that I read was throwing all kinds of new information and really fascinating topics, as it often is, peering into the past. So just thank you for coming on the show and sharing some of your work with us, and being so open and also sharing a beautiful story of your career and research. It's really been a pleasure.
Well, thank you very much. It was a lot of fun.